Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
New U.S. sanctions on Iran took effect today, 6 months after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the international nuclear deal.
The sanctions target Iran's shipping, financial, and energy sectors, all key to the country's already struggling economy.
The bombs, which the FBI referred to as improvised explosive devices, were sent to the FBI's bomb laboratory in Quantico, Virginia.
We're in Mexico again tonight as thousands of migrants try to find a faster way to the U.S. border. The White House says it's now getting help from the Mexican.
Breaking news out of Pittsburgh. The man accused in the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh is pleading not guilty, and he also wants a jury trial. You can see he's facing a 44-count.
In the final seconds before the Boeing 737 MAX crashed into the water, it was traveling at more than 500 kilometers an hour. All 189 people on board were killed.
You've now entered the House of Mystery.
Crime, conspiracy, history, and science.
With your hosts, Al Warren, Mike Brown,
Julie Sav, Michael Butterfield,
Dr. Joseph Usinski, and Michael Hawley.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm your host today, Al Warren. Joining me from the heat of Arizona, we've got Michael Butterfield. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing well, Al. How are you?
I'm fine. So you got your vaccinations?
Yes, I am partially vaccinated, two shots, and just waiting for another week and a half for it to fully settle in. So
wow.
Hopefully it'll work.
Wild. Yeah,
very
that's
grateful.
Great. Yeah.
Very grateful that I was able to get that.
So you can go to Florida and party with the rest of them.
Yeah, because that was my plan all along. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, now today we've got quite the story. We've got we're dealing with a nonfiction true crime story. We're dealing with a book called Facing the Yorkshire Ripper. And we've got the author of that with us from the UK, Mo Lee. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah. How's it going over there in the UK? You guys are in lockdown again?
Yes. Seems never ending at the moment. But I've had my vaccination too. And
good.
People are gathering on Monday. We're allowed to meet in the garden. So, and then there's the barbecue time, and everyone's trying to behave and not go too far. But we're doing okay. But it's very difficult in Europe. As it is over with you.
Yeah.
Strange times. Very strange.
Isn't it strange to say the words, we're allowed to meet in the garden?
I know. Who'd have thought it? Hurrah!
Yeah.
Getting excited about that.
Yeah. The little things matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They sure do. Yeah.
It's strange. I think one of the strangest things the pandemic has done for me is I realize how strangely people act and react to things that go on like this. And that really ties in with your book and kind of your experience too. It's just amazing the different types of reactions that people have to bad events, bad tragedy and stuff like that. And,
we
see
yeah.
that every day all over the, you know, the world. We see people reacting, like, you know. So how did you get to write a book? Like, what was it? We know what you went through and stuff, and we'll talk about that. But what about this that made you decide, well, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to tell my story.
Okay.
Yeah, because
well, that's a big question.
Well, it is, and, but I think it puts you out in the public, right? It makes people aware of who you are by doing that. So is there, what's your primary reason?
Well, the book has taken me 30 years to write, and it all started on the back of a investigative journalist TV program, which had unearthed some documents about the case, the Yorkshire Ripper. And I was interviewed, and it raised a lot of questions, and I started to write. As the program was aired, that was 1996, and since then I've been in quite a few documentaries as a survivor of Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. But yeah, I wanted to tell it my way, because by the time you've been filmed and all the best bits have hit the cutting room floor, they started to make me feel like, well, I'm just another victim. I haven't really got a voice. They're not interested in me as a person. It's more of a statistic. And I wanted to explain that there's quite a unique vantage of being part of the story and a victim and a survivor. But all the best bits aren't told. It's always about the shock horror, you know, which I understand in context. But I needed to redress the balance and put my version of events down.
So in essence, you're really kind of saying that it gives you the opportunity to kind of give out what was really important about the experience more than what the shows do. Because, I mean, a lot of the documentaries and shows are trying to, you're right, they're trying to shock people. They're trying to, you know, they want everybody on the edge of their seat the whole time. And
well, I understand that in the media, and that's part of the narrative, but it's not all of the narrative.
So let's maybe go through what happened to you. Let's talk about how you faced the Yorkshire Ripper and kind of what how did it happen?
Okay, so I was an art student at Leeds, which is a big city in Yorkshire, and we were being told at the time, because the Yorkshire Ripper had his grip of fear on the whole of the county, if not the country. And even the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was saying that women should not go out alone. However, it was my 21st birthday coming up in the week, and I wanted to meet friends to plan a little party. And for the first time ever, I was out on my own. My boyfriend at the time had gone to London to do be part of a CND march, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We were all very politicized as young art students. And I ventured through town to meet my friends in the student quarter of the city of Leeds. And we planned, we didn't have much money. We had a couple of beers, and then we decided to leave about 9:45 in the evening. It was a Saturday night. There were still people about, and we walked from the pub up to the park. It was dark, it was gloomy and cold, and my friend said, sure you don't want us to walk you into town, where I was going to get my bus to the other half of the city? No, I'll be fine, I'll be absolutely fine, don't worry. You know, I didn't want my life to be managed by fear. I was only 20 at the time. And so they let me go, and I walked through Leeds University campus, which was very well lit. Not many people about because of this curfew that had been imposed. And I thought, I'll take a shortcut. I'll go down this side street so I can get to my bus stop quicker, so I can get a faster bus home. And as I turned round the side of the university campus, there was a light out, a street light out, and it was a little dark, but it wasn't an alley. It was a two-sided street. And as I walked, I heard this voice as I was halfway down this lane. "Hey, you, hi, how are you doing?" Really friendly young man appeared. I stopped in my tracks and turned about to face him. And he was really chatty and very charming. And I thought, I must know him. You know, he's ever so friendly. He's probably a friend from my student area or in the university. And then as I got closer, I saw his face and I didn't recognize him. So I decided to go, "Yeah, okay, fine, bye, see ya," and increased my pace to get to the main road that was ahead of me, about 50 yards, 60 yards. And as I did, I heard these footsteps behind me, and they got quicker and quicker, and I realized I was in danger. And my knees went to jelly. I had this terrible fear, and I started to run for my life. And as I ran, he ran, and we were both really, really running as fast as we could. Before I got to the end of the road, I felt this massive whack to the top of my head, and all I could see was the pavement coming up towards my face, and that's how I was attacked. So I don't remember anything from that point except waking up in a hospital bed.
Jeez.
Yeah.
And of course, so the Yorkshire Ripper, how many victims had he had already by that time? Was this something well known?
Well, I think it must have been edging up towards 12, 11, 13 victims in total that had been reported and acknowledged by the West Yorkshire Police.
So you weren't in fear of the Yorkshire. You didn't think it's not going to happen to me, right? That's
exactly. Yeah, you know, you're a young person. You think you're untouchable, don't you? And mm-hmm. It was the first night I'd been out for many times, and I thought I was being sensible. It wasn't too late, but we were under a curfew, and the studios, the art studios, were empty. No one went out anymore. But I'm a social person, you know, from Liverpool. I like to have a chat and a drink, and so did all my friends. So we weren't going to put that off to plan my 21st birthday. Otherwise, I might have thought twice about going out on my own.
Yeah, yeah. But I think a key point is it's something it's just not going to happen to you, right? That's something that...
As a student from the other side of the Pennines, it wasn't affecting us so much as it was the local population in Yorkshire. And you kind of feel like you're a bit of a tourist in the town, you know? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't our story, it was the Yorkshire story, and we were just visiting, it seemed.
Plus, at that time, he hadn't been attacking students or anything. It just seemed like he was attacking working girls and all that, right?
So. Working girls, women of the street, prostitutes. He was attacking them, it seems, but actually as the years progressed, he would attack students, anyone who was out on their own, no matter who they were. So he wasn't just targeting prostitutes, but that was the general consensus of the press and the media, that he was attacking prostitutes.
So when you woke up in the hospital, and you realized that someone had attacked you or something had happened, right? What was on your mind? Were you thinking it was the Yorkshire Ripper, or what came across your mind?
I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea. I was so dazed, and all I wanted to do was find my shoes, phone a taxi, and go home. I didn't realize the intensity of my injuries, and I was also very heavily medicated, and I remember waking up and groaning, and then the nurse rolling me over and giving me an injection on my backside, and I just fell asleep, and I was very drowsy and very shaken and very shocked, and very disorientated for many days and weeks afterwards.
Because it was much worse than just a blow to the head, right?
Oh, yeah. It was repeated hammer blows to the top of my head. Two puncture wounds to the base of my skull, which just missed my spinal cord by millimeters.
And that was with a sharpened screwdriver, right?
Yeah, sharpened screwdriver, yeah. And my jaw was completely smashed open, cracked open. And my fractures to my skull, fractures to my cheekbone, cuts to the inside of my mouth where my jaw had bitten my tongue, you know, and bruised knees and hands from where I had fallen so heavily. Yeah, I was really lucky to be alive.
Yeah, and can you talk about that a little bit, about Lorna Smith and how the role she played?
Yeah. So Lorna Smith was at that very moment walking at the T-junction of the main road, and she heard me scream, apparently. Let out a yelp. I don't remember. And she stopped with her friend, and she turned around, and she could see in the shadows me on the crumpled heap on the pavement, and a man over me who was wielding some blunt instrument. He saw her, otherwise it would have been the final blow for me, and he ran off into the dark. So she saved my life. And she called an ambulance, and if it wasn't for Lorna, I wouldn't be here. So we keep in touch every year. Very special woman.
Wow. And you were attacked in October 1980, and I read that you were staying with your parents and trying to recover when you saw the man who attacked you on TV when Peter Sutcliffe was finally arrested.
Yeah.
What was that like to see that face on TV and in the context that he had been caught?
Yeah, well, I was on my own. I was watching the BBC News, and then it was a huge story. And then I saw his face on the TV screen, and I recognized him. And I fell to my knees. I was absolutely shocked to the core. But at the same time, Alan, I was terrified. I was going to be labeled as a woman of the night, as a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be part of that horror story. It was too big. It was monstrous. The whole thing was incomprehensibly terrifying. So I kept it hidden for many years that I recognized his face. For many years, I was too frightened. All I wanted to do was to get back to art school and complete my final year of my fine art degree. That was at the forefront of my mind. Because if I was going to sit back and be subsumed by the pain and anguish and fear, then I don't know what would have happened to me.
And Sutcliffe was convicted of killing 13 women, and I think he attacked at least 9 other people.
Yeah.
When you heard that he had killed so many women, did that have any effect on how you viewed what happened to you? I mean, would it even be possible to feel lucky after what he did to you?
Well, it was terrifying to see all the names rolled out, so many people. And I surely did feel extraordinarily lucky to be alive. And that's what powered me on, because I'd escaped, you know, such a terrible attack. As bad as it was, I was alive, and I could walk, and I could talk, and I could paint, and I could draw, and I could communicate, and I just felt blessed to be alive.
And, of course, Peter Sutcliffe never admitted that he attacked you. Why do you think he denied that when he already confessed to more than a dozen murders, I think, like less than 2 days after his arrest? What was his reason for that?
Well, oh, gosh, that is a big question. I think he'd probably done so many, he'd lost track of his records. Also, I think he was withholding the attack on me and another victim, Tracy Brown, as a bit of a power thing over the years. I think he thought he held his cards close to his chest, knowing that the police knew and I knew and everyone knew that it was him, but he refused to confess. And that has been an absolute thorn in my side all of my life, because he was never convicted. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book as well, because I needed to explain how that feels.
So after it happened initially and you were in the hospital, did the police suspect that it was Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper,
well,
or did they not?
That's another very good question. What was happening at the time of my attack is that the police were being held to account, and there were people saying, how come after 5 years this murderer is on the loose and you've got a massive squad of detectives and policemen and women, and they were just terrified to have another victim on their hands that had, so they decided to brush my attack under the carpet, because it was better for them to keep it quashed and the story of my attack to be hidden, because they'd be ridiculed less. So that was their strategy. It seems crazy, but they were so worried about being, you know, judged by the public who were thinking that they were incompetent, and the whole nation was beginning to wonder why, you know, all this manpower wasn't finding this particular piece of Sutcliffe. But in fact, behind the scenes, there was another level of detectives who knew it was Peter Sutcliffe, but the upper echelons in the Ripper squad, the higher level thinkers, so to speak, which begs the question, were sidetracked by a hoax tape that addressed the Ripper squad, and he said that he would attack soon. He had a Geordie accent and was sending tapes and handwriting, and the West Yorkshire police put all their eggs in one basket and decided that this Geordie hoaxer was the killer, and no one else could deviate from that, which seems alarming. Even Miss Marple wouldn't have written that. You know, it was absolutely insane, and common sense did not prevail at that point.
Wow.
Well, Peter Sutcliffe was not unique, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of other serial killers, Ted Bundy and the Green River Killer. And the prominent theory is that they hated women. And that may seem like a simplistic explanation, but what do you think about Sutcliffe's motivations, and how do you think the hatred of women in society contributes to violence against women?
Well, first of all, no one is born evil, you know. It's a society that can make people distort their thinking. And at that time, in the 70s, you know, women were strangely considered second class, and they weren't important. It was a very male-dominated society. It was a very sexist society. And you could even say it was a misogynistic society. And that contributed, our culture contributed to the making of Peter Sutcliffe, because women were page 3 girls, they were called the birds, you know, you weren't supposed to have a career, you were supposed to be a housewife, have babies, look after your man, and all of that seemed to be the overarching identity of young women at the time, despite the Second World War, where we'd had women pilots, women engineers, Rosie the Riveter, we had the female land army. It seems as though that had never happened. And it reverted back to keeping women in their place. That was the main cultural divide between men and women, and that men were much more superior.
And you said something that, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, you said something that really struck me when you said that back then women were told not even to go out. And about 2 weeks ago, a young woman named Sarah Everard was abducted and killed in South London, and a police officer was arrested. And there's been protests and worldwide discussions about women's safety in public. And does it sometimes feel like nothing has changed over the last 40
years?
Well,
that's a really good point. That's a very, very good point. And I've been interviewed on the radio and the local and the national media about my feelings on that. And it is like we haven't progressed for 40 years. It was 40 years ago that I was attacked and 40 years ago that Sutcliffe was arrested. And here we are, having women holding vigils, wanting to reclaim the streets. And that was happening 40 years ago. What's happened to society? It's raised a lot of questions about women's rights and women being able to walk home alone at night. Mm-hmm. While we're all very sensible, men and women, about where we walk in the dark. We don't go to places where we think it's dangerous, but it's raised a lot of questions, and particularly being a policeman who assaulted this and killed this poor young woman. It's began a campaign of Reclaim the Streets.
Yeah, and we're always telling women to take precautions to protect themselves instead of addressing how men behave. So.
Yeah. And I think that's valid. I think that's perfectly valid. But then that's just human nature. You would ordinarily protect yourself. You wouldn't put yourself in a position of danger. Perhaps that's more at the forefront of the female mind. I don't know. I'd hate to kind of stereotype, but it's part of our society. We as women have to be careful. Just goes with the. It just goes with the that's how we feel. But that's interesting because, you know, there are men who also have to be careful.
Yes.
And there are also gay communities where you have to be careful where you go, and you have to be very guarded. There's always an issue, but at the moment it's at the fore that it's for women to try and reclaim their nights, reclaim the streets, and question why is this still happening.
How did you recover then? It sounded like you kept it secret for quite a while. When did you let people know? When did you come out with what you were hiding, so to speak? When did that happen?
Well, in 1993, I'd been in denial for nearly 10 years more. And you know what? It served me well, because I could just pretend I was fine. I just had an accident, you know, and played it down. Because if you build it up into something big, it can rather define you. Mm-hmm. So in 1993, the police, West Yorkshire Police, phoned me to say that Yorkshire Television were doing a investigative documentary about Peter Sutcliffe, and they wanted to interview me. Well, I thought, well, that's it. The cat's out the bag now. That's the TV. And I had a choice whether I could go on and talk or carry on pretending. So I went and spoke, but I didn't show my face to the television camera. I just spoke, and they filmed the back of me, and me and Tracy Brown, and they unfolded the story of how the police were criticised by the Byford Report, which was an independent report on how the police had how the police hadn't managed to catch the Ripper and all of the errors. Well, it's easy in hindsight to criticise the police, but this was the very first documentary that had actually opened up the scandalous and terrible misogynistic attitude of the police at the time.
You were in a Netflix documentary recently. And how does it feel to be able to tell your story to a much larger audience now?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I feel like a responsibility as a survivor to claim some ground in this big story by saying, you know, you can survive. We are more than just, you know, what happened in 5 minutes in my life has certainly not defined me completely. And the book has got a unique golden thread through it, and it's about how you navigate unwanted media interest, how you get over the lack of support from the legal system, how you manage to be creative and be the best person you can be despite what's happened to you. And that's the unique part about the book. So it's good to be on Netflix, but more recently I was on Channel 5, and that was aired about a month ago. And it showed me as a survivor, and it was aired 2 weeks after Peter Sutcliffe passed away. So it was very loaded. Mm-hmm. So I've been in quite a few documentaries and quite a few radio interviews, and I'm using the press to get the message out there that stop defining victims of crime as these insipid, vulnerable women. We know we're not that. There's more to us all than that. And to try and change the narrative and turn it around into a positive one.
Well, and that's interesting that you just said that, because you've talked a lot about how expressing yourself through art has been a positive force in your life. And could you tell us a little bit about that, and then also about your how you dealt with your drawing of Peter Sutcliffe, which I found a really interesting way of addressing
that. That was great. So I returned back to art school after the attack, still with my jaw wired up, and went into the etching studios, and I was looking at a lot of political and satirical art. And I thought, right, I need to make a comment on this. So I started to express how I was feeling in these very dark, macabre drawings, which were really not the kind of pictures that I was doing before, which is all colourful and pretty. And they were very macabre and very sinister drawings of revenge and how I felt about being attacked, and about how people were baying to hang the Yorkshire Ripper once he'd been found. And that was my final degree. And then I just carried on drawing and exhibiting every few years ever since I left art school. I was fortunate enough to go and live in California, and I did a whole series of works But ultimately, the last piece of work, one of the last pieces of work I did was I went through a very unusual but very powerful therapy called schema conditioning therapy. And it allowed me to look at that iconic photograph of Peter Sutcliffe in his wedding suit with his bow tie. And a young filmmaker said, do you think you could draw that? I said, yeah, easily now. I'm over my fear, really over it. So I objectified the photograph and stuck it to the drawing board and drew it as honestly as I possibly can, because I'm quite good at drawing true to life. I trained as an archaeological illustrator as well.
Oh, wow.
And my partner came in, and they looked at, what the heck are you doing? You're drawing the man that tried to kill you? I'm like, yeah, I'm just trying to get the eyes right. I can do the hair, but I'm not sure about the mouth. What do you think? Is it a likeness? And I was more interested in getting the likeness and the overall impact of the drawing than the person who it was, which was a massive leap of courage, because it didn't frighten me. So this particular drawing was filmed, and I was in the studio, and I ripped up the drawing of the Ripper into little fragments of paper that fell to the floor, and I walked across his face, but which was all torn apart and out of the frame of the camera. And it was the most empowering thing I'd done. I turned the tables. I turned Sutcliffe into an object, and I was the survivor. It was the most amazing, amazing feeling, and that's written in the last part of the book about how I've survived. Yeah, I'm very proud of that.
It was an amazing drawing, amazing likeness.
Yeah. Well, like I say, you know, if you're an archaeological illustrator for a while, you learn you can't really represent things. You've got to be true to the object, because other researchers will look at the brooch or the half coin and check that it's as and photography can do so much, but the drawings were for researchers, really. So you have to be very honest with what you were trying to represent, and that's what I did. I used that talent to draw Peter Sutcliffe's face. Yeah,
and you feel,
thinking about it, it's quite extraordinary. Yeah.
And you feel like that was a turning point for you. So I want to ask you, as you mentioned, last year, Peter Sutcliffe was infected with the coronavirus in prison and died shortly after that, which some people thought was a very small piece of justice. Where were you when you heard that news, and how did it make you feel?
Well, I knew what people were saying. Good riddance, you know. Thank God he's gone, and all the rest of it. And may he rot in hell. And all of this rhetoric was coming out. But inside, I was furious, because he'd taken his secret and his the possibility of any confession about his attack on me to his grave. So it wasn't a joyous occasion. It wasn't sad. It made me pretty angry. But the thing is with me is that if I'm angry, I tend to be creative. It's quite a good driving force. So I've been very productive since, and still am, and enjoy my artwork immensely. In fact, treasure it even more now. He didn't take that part of me away. He didn't kill me as an artist. He didn't kill me, but he certainly didn't take my art. My love of art away. No way.
Wow.
What do you think his intention was?
What, when he attacked me?
Yeah. Do you think that? What do you think he was about? What's your opinion of him?
I think where he attacked me was next to a big church, which had some grounds behind it and a very low wall. And that's where the light was out. And Sutcliffe was a grave digger. And I think that after he'd got me unconscious, I think he was going to take me into the grounds of the church, which was right next to the student campus, and really I don't say what he could have done, but I think that was what he was intending to do.
So what do you want people to get out of your book? What do you hope people take away when they read Facing the Yorkshire Ripper?
Yeah, I think what I'd really like them to get out of it is the fact that, you know, you can triumph over these evil things. And it is a unique approach. While true crime has its place, this is a two-pronged approach to telling the Ripper story, which it does, telling about the attack, which it does, all of that. It also tells the flip side of that in terms of how my artwork helped me and how I survived and how I treasured my life, and it gave me an edge. And I want people to go, yeah, you know, that's sweet justice in itself.
Say to a survivor of some sort of crime like this, what is your kind of your recommendations? What should they do?
Well, I think they should talk about it. I think they should get free of charge, proper therapy, proper counselling by skilled people, and I think they should get some kind of support and acknowledgement. I mean, I did have this fantasy whereby people who were attacked and these vicious, terrible attacks, I'd raise enough money through a charity called Victim Support, and I'd build a big house on the seafront on the coast, and you could do all your creative work there and talk about your fear both at the same time, and so that the fear isn't just said in one way. There's an outcome of positivity that should always be sourced or searched for or aimed for, rather than just retelling the morbid narrative. There's got to be more to help people who have had these terrible atrocities happen in their lives, to try and look beyond that if they can, and to take courage. They have courage. You need to dig deep and find courage, which isn't easy for everybody, and I do empathize with anyone who's been attacked, but it can be very life-changing.
What was the biggest challenge for you afterwards? Like, what was it that you had to overcome more than anything?
Okay. Well, when you've been hospitalized and you've been sedated for so long and your physical recoveries are difficult, you know, I couldn't raise my head off the pillow. I couldn't lie flat for 3 weeks. I was very, very frightened of falling and re-breaking the bones in my head. And I went back to Leeds, and with the intention of returning to my art, which I did, but there were times when I did not want to leave the house. I was scared. I was really, really scared, because by the time I'd returned in the December, the Yorkshire Ripper was still on the loose, and I was worried he'd come and find me and finish me off. So that was the biggest, most frightening time of my life, but I managed to get into the art studios. I had my final degree, and I had to do that. That had to be my priority, and that priority had to be the forefront of my mind and not my fear. That was really hard.
So it's something that stays with you even to this day, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. It does. And strangely, it does. But it's not a companion, it's not a friend, it's just part of who I am. But I want to raise money for Women's Aid and for Victim Support, and I've done that in the past by selling my artwork. And I want to show a positive, sounds really crazy, how can you have a positive side to the Yorkshire Ripper story?
Yeah.
But you can, you know, you can raise money, you can give people beautiful pictures of beautiful things, and my website shows all these gorgeous, gorgeous birds, ironically, you know, for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy making beautiful things, and sometimes people look at me and just say, well, how can you do that? How can you do that with what's happening? Well, why not? I can still draw. I can make beautiful things, and that's what I endeavor to do, and that's what I was put on the planet to do, and not be a victim.
So how much you're doing artwork? You have a studio and everything. What kind of artwork do you do?
Well, I draw moths and butterflies and birds and all kinds, but mainly my stimulus is to draw from natural forms, seashells and nature. That's where my passion really sits, and to be accurate and honest and give a, you can't beat nature for beauty, can you, really? So that's where I start. And I've got two studios. One is a messy studio for doing windy seascapes, which is in a converted garage down at the block of flats that I live, which is all lit up and it's been floored, and I can make a mess down there and make very dynamic pictures. And then in the upstairs studio, which is next door where I'm talking, I've got plan chests, I've got all my artwork, I've got over 1,000 pencils, paints, acrylics, all kinds of gorgeous paper. It's very organized. I'm not one of these artists who's, you know, messy. I'm quite systematic about how I produce the work. And I sell it in the local art gallery, the originals, and prints I sell in a little art shop in the town where I live and where I work and help people. Yeah, it's great. My life is good.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, that's a good example for people to know that something like that doesn't define you, and that there's so much more to life.
Oh, there is. And it's spring, you know, and you can't be drawing all these gorgeous things that are appearing at the moment. So it's life-affirming. The horror story is life-affirming. That's my approach to the book, and that's what comes out of the book as well.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write the book? How long did it take you to get that put together?
30 years.
Oh, did you actually start writing it 30 years ago?
30 years ago, yeah. So I started writing with the first documentary in 1990, which was aired in 1994, because I noticed that what I said on camera wasn't necessarily what was edited. It was all edited out, you know, because they had to kind of stick to their side of the story. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is my story. I've got this other side. So it took many forms, but over the years, I finished it properly last year. Before it went into publication, and it was a real lot of work, many years of work, and sometimes it was too frightening, and I put it away, and then I'd come on, Mo, you've got to get it out there, and through meeting people in the media, I managed to get in touch with a really brilliant agent, who managed to find me Pen and Sword, who published the book, so it's doing well.
What was it that actually got you to decide to go to a publisher or an agent and actually put it out there? Was there a particular point in your life?
Yeah, it was the point was when I drew Peter Sutcliffe and ripped it off and it was made into a film, I thought, well, if that isn't worth writing about and getting it out there, I don't know what is. And that it was at that point that really fueled me on to say, you know, because that's quite something. That is something that's like, wow. So it was that galvanized all of my energy to finally do the last lap and get it into print.
Yeah, because it's pretty, because in a way you make yourself vulnerable again, right? You put out this story from
You can do
that you went through.
You certainly can make yourself, you know, it is a risk, it's a gamble, how you're going to be perceived afterwards. But if you've been honest, which was the most frightening thing that I learned as a writer, is that if you're going to be a writer about yourself, you're going to have to be honest. And I'm like, really? Do I have to? Warts and all. And it is an honest book, and it can make me feel vulnerable at times. But there's the honesty of survival and the honesty of creativity that's in there that balances it out. So it's a good read as well, people have said. It's a good page-turner. So I was quite brutal with every draft. I would say, stop rambling, this is rambling, and get to the chase, get to the point, and how which pictures can illustrate which chapter best. And it's consolidated well, I think.
So now, do you have a website yourself?
Yes, I do. It's artistmolea.com. artistmolea.com.
Okay, and we'll put that on our website as well. People listening can
they can
find
have
you
a look. Yeah, have
book.
A look at
yeah.
Some very cheerful and rather beautiful pictures. Also, on the website, the film is there, so they can look at the film of me ripping up the Ripper.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yes, it's worth watching.
Yeah, and also the link to buy the book from Pen and Sword is there. So they do sales to the US, which is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good. It's really good. And how's it been with the art world for during the COVID in this last year?
I painted over 40 pictures, most of them which are on the website. I just, strangely, for the first part of the lockdown from COVID, I was very, very productive because, hey, I'm in isolation. I've got no excuse. I can't go shopping. I can't meet my friends. Oh, I know. I'll just make more work, more artwork. So I was very, very productive. But then during the winter, it's been really hard. But you can't stop me making stuff. That's what keeps me going. But it has been very strange.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like in your artwork, too, you do a lot of beautiful things.
Yeah.
But yet you have, there was that, this Yorkshire tragedy that happened. Yeah. How you were able to change that in your artwork is pretty, pretty amazing. Not to be, you know, I'd expect you to be doing something darker.
Well, yeah. I did do a lot of dark work early on. That isn't on the website, but it is in the book. And if you download it, you can get a Kindle version. You can see all the dark, macabre, sad, gloomy, angst-ridden artwork, which is a very good outlet and it was a very good vent. But you can't sustain that. You'll just go nuts, you know. And then within a short space of time, once I'd got that all out of my system, I was drawing lizards in Greece and dragonflies and swallows and, you know, it doesn't take much of a shift. But I'm the kind of artist that will move on. I get bored quite easily. I don't have a particular style except this true representational way of responding to the natural world. And that's something that will never part with me. But, yeah, the dark work had its place and it was important outlet because I couldn't talk. That was the thing. I couldn't say anything because I was so frightened of being judged at the time as a young woman for being in the wrong place. And I just thought, well, the only outlet I had was through a visual representation of how I was feeling. So that served its purpose very early on.
Wow. Do you think you're going to write some more books or more about this, or is this done?
Well, might be another version. I started to write two chapters, one after I was interviewed because the police started to identify me more formally as a victim of Yorkshire Ripper. As for years it was all a bit unclear, but as it's become clearer now, so that's been quite a consolation. And I also wrote a chapter about what was happening in the UK when Sutcliffe died and the commentary and how that was perceived. And then, of course, I'm also aware of what's happened with Sarah Everard, and that's brought up a lot of issues. And I'm currently working on a street art project about how forgotten female victims of violent crime often fall through the legal system. And that's going to happen in May, because in May, Peter Sutcliffe would have been 40 years since he was convicted at the Old Bailey.
Wow.
So there's something to look out for. And I'll put the news on my website when that's happening as well.
So, a tough question. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to forgive him?
Mm. Well, you say him as though he's a person. It's really odd, you know. He's kind of like a nobody because I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. I can't forget the whole terrifying grip that he had on the nation and the influence that he had on you know, the streets and the impact that the media had as well, the media frenzy, who also contributed to this monster being, you know, emerged when he was just an ordinary bloke who was a truck driver. So it never really leaves my mind, but it certainly doesn't occupy it 24/7. And if it does come up, you know, I'm really feel very, very honoured and proud to be able to talk to you on your radio show, then I will. I'll talk about what it's like. So it starts to demystify these victims, you know, and that we can all, everybody has a story. Everybody has a tragedy, you know, but they're not often given a chance to voice how they've recovered. And I feel very, very pleased to be able to do that.
Wow, we're glad you did, and, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much
for coming on.
Thank you.
The book we're talking about is Facing the Yorkshire Ripper, The Art of Survival, and our guest is the author, Mo Lee.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.